This is the Skin Science Podcast. I'm Dr. Thomas Hitchcock, and here we'll investigate everything skin science and dissect it from a scientific perspective, analyze it from a medical perspective, critique it from a consumer perspective, and give insight from an industry perspective. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. I'm Dr. Thomas Hitchcock, and with me in the studio is Ms. Angela Wilson-McDonald. How are you doing, Angela?
I'm doing great, Thomas.
You're still sick?
Good to see you. I'm still sick. I am actually still sick, but hanging in there. Well, that's without question.
It is a head cold.
Correct? So. It is a head cold. It's a head cold. It's just an average head cold. I've been tested. It's just an average head cold.
All right. Well, that's good because I don't want more than an average head cold
there
if I
go.
Get it. So.
There you go.
And we have our guest from the last episode back on with us, Dr. Jigna Patel. How are you?
Doing well. Still here on a Monday. So, yes. I'm not sick. Fingers crossed.
Yes. And we got in the peanut gallery, we've got our producers, Seti and Alan. How are you guys doing?
Doing great. How about you?
Good. I think in today's episode, I'm going to call on you guys at the end. So pay attention because I want to see what you digest from this as non-scientists.
Oh, wow.
Oh, okay.
Right. Really?
You're
putting them to the test.
Oh, my God.
Do y'all need a pen and paper to take notes?
I guess we've got to pay
attention. Just let it absorb. Wash over
oh,
you.
Oh, boy.
All right.
Okay.
So why don't you give us a little background on Dr. Patel before we get going?
I would love to. And if you want to hear her full bio, that was in our previous episode. But Dr. Jigna Patel of Vedaskin is in the Essex area of London, started her career after a prestigious medical school experience at the King's College of London School of Medicine. She started her career in medicine with pediatrics and then shifted into general practice in 2015. But most interesting the last 3 years, and really why we invited her on this podcast, is she's been in a transition period to adopt and evolve a blended one approach. And that means integrating holistic well-being, longevity supplementation. She's a clinical lead advisor for Haneo Technology and connecting the dots between mind, body, and skin to heighten her skill base and presence from an industry educational perspective. So she's really bringing to her patients and other like-minded clinicians a really holistic, why are you chuckling, Thomas?
Sorry, I just saw you struggling to try to summarize.
I am not struggling whatsoever, but really to bring what we're going to talk about today, because today's topic is gut-brain-skin connection and that idea that while we are fully focused on the skin every day and skin mm-hmm. science, that fortunately we have clinicians like Dr. Patel in the market that are evaluating patients on a much larger scale and the connection between what they do, how they live their life, what they ingest, supplements that they take, how that also can affect their skin beyond what we do from in the aesthetics industry. So
yes,
we're thrilled to have you, Dr. Patel.
And it was okay that you struggled.
I didn't struggle. I wasn't struggling whatsoever.
I'm just kidding.
It's okay.
It's just because I knew that she...
I don't know what my name is.
She was just trying in real time.
I have a cold.
All right. So before we get started, everybody knows that science is a puzzle and I love puzzles. And so this one I brought today is actually pretty special because this is the first puzzle that I myself actually designed and built. And this is a prototype I'm actually going to be making out of metal, but it is actually pretty cool, right? It's a chalice, and I won't give away all the secrets, but this will be available. I'm not trying to sell it out here. So it's going to be way too expensive because it's made out of metal, so only puzzle collectors are going to probably want to pay the money for it. But it's super exciting to me because it brings all the things together for me as far as my creativity and my mind and all that stuff. And so, but speaking of mind, as you alluded to, we're going to be talking today about not just skin and not just the mind either, but also the gut. And so how are these things connected? And frankly, we tend to stop there, the gut, brain, skin, but there's a very big possibility that there's even more things that are connected via the way that these three things are connected. And so this is something that... A lot of people may have a very cursory understanding of. Nobody knows everything about this subject matter, but we do know that there's a lot of evidence and more evidence, it seems like almost every day, that there is a huge impact on the things that we eat and the manifestations on our skin. And also now we're finding out that what we put on our skin actually can affect the way that we digest foods and the way that our immune system acts, and also the way that our minds react to certain things. And so it's more complicated than that even, so we'll get into a little bit more detail in a second. But one of the things that I think is an old saying is you are what you eat, right? And so that's something that even the smallest child understands at least a little bit, is that if you eat good things, you become healthy or better. If you eat bad things, you become not as healthy. And the real question is, do we understand why it is? And that's the same with skin as it is with the gut, in the sense that a lot of people think when I eat nutrients, that's what drives health or not being healthy, one or the other. And people also think the same thing about skincare. If I put some molecule in my skin, that's what makes my skin healthy or not healthy. But at the end of the day, what they forgot is that there's a whole ecosystem of organisms in both places, that the things that you put into your gut or onto your skin actually are turned into completely different substances than what you put there. And that actually is something that is super important, because I like to give the analogy of when we drink wine. I don't know if everybody likes wine. I'm not a big wine drinker. I know you like some wine now and then. Wine is actually something where people, when you ask them, where did the alcohol come from in wine? The grapes did not make the alcohol. The grapes made sugar. And then a microorganism turned that sugar into alcohol during the fermentation process. And that's not that dissimilar to what happens when we ingest food. It actually then starts to be digested, which means it's broken into the most smallest parts. And then those things are subjected to the metabolism of microbes before we even get to it. Because think about this. The lining of the gut is lined with microbes. They get the first pass. You know, we don't necessarily get the first pass. And on the skin, guess what gets first pass? The microbes. And so that makes it even more salient that we keep in mind that when we talk about the connection between the gut, the mind, and the skin, a lot of it has to do with the microbes and connecting the microbes with those things. Dr. Patel, your thoughts?
Yeah, exactly. And I think, just because I have a pediatric background, even if you take it down to the basics of how we're made, so a little bit of embryology, mm-hmm. you know, we start off as a ball of cells with no opening. We then develop folds and features, and then fold in on ourselves. And actually, we form layers. They're called derms, an ecto, a meso, and an endoderm. And you've quite rightly said, I think, previously and in your book, you know, gut and skin especially, it's really clever. So it's a continuum. The endoderm is predominantly what makes your gastrointestinal tract. Mm-hmm. And that merges with the ectoderm that goes all the way around the outside. And that's what forms your central nervous system and your skin. So behaviors of both. So even just having that concept, okay, that's how we might actually be connected. And then everything in between is pretty much all the other organs that we're not going to list and name. So embryologically, we're already interconnected. It, mm-hmm. it doesn't just happen later on in life. We're born that way. And I really find it inspiring to go back to some of my pediatric days. And even now, it's that we take so much care to look after newborn babies, right? Mm-hmm. We look after their skin, there's certain things we avoid doing, there's certain ways we feed them. And then understanding that how certain things that happen that go wrong with them, how that manifests on their skin. So I see a lot of that in general practice. Obviously, I have a subspecialty in child health. So I'm forever dealing with babies, for instance, who have cow's milk protein allergy, whether it's immune mediated or not. And it's not so obvious. They might come with a skin manifestation like a rash or eczema or something else, and then you have to unpick and unwind and go, actually, is it a skin problem or is it mm-hmm. their gut? Is it because they've got an allergy, and is that something we need to fix first? So I'm so used to doing that, but I think it's a concept that if we start to understand a bit more, then we change our practice as well in that way. But I've noticed, especially in the last 18 months to 2 years, that people are making gut and brain connections. So people will talk about that in isolation. And then they're making gut and skin connections, mm-hmm. talking about that in isolation. But not realizing it's all connected, mm-hmm. and then throw a bit of immune system and a bit of hormones and a bit of psychology. And it's actually a huge connection with about five different words in it. Mm-hmm. So if we're that in, it's worth knowing, because then how disease presents and how we feel, whether it's psychological or physical, starts to make sense.
Right, absolutely. And one of the, you mentioned the book, Rebooting the Biome. That is something where we did go into detail, and there was an analogy we used about a house, our body being like a house. And that's when I wrote that analogy, I knew it would eventually fall apart with, you know, if you go far enough. But that's not the point. The point is we're just trying to kind of give the ideas of, when you look at a house, when you walk in the door, you think you're inside the house. But in reality, you could take your hand and continuously touch the house and go inside and outside, and it's not, you really don't have to pass any barriers. But if I'm trying to go into where the electrical circuitry is and stuff, I'd have to punch a hole through the house somewhere. That is, in my opinion, the inside of the house. Technically, where we reside is just a different environment of the outside of the house. It's the inside of the outside, if you will, which is like the gut. And one of the reasons why that's an important distinction is because just like our biomes in our gut versus our skin, what lives on the outside of our homes, whether it's moss or you know, the birds or something, don't necessarily live on the inside of the home. Because the inside of the home has less access to the things that those things on the outside need. It's a different temperature a lot of times because we have air conditioning or heat. It's a lot of times sealed a little bit too well. And so, you know, there's a lot of reasons why certain things don't grow inside and certain things grow outside. It's the same with the skin and the gut, where what grows on the skin may not be able to grow in the gut, and vice versa, because they're very different environments. Even within those two systems, there's many, many different environments where different things grow more or less. Now, one of the things that I will say is when it comes to the microbiome of the skin and the gut, I think there's a little bit of information that we're still trying to analyze and understand around. I think we believe that there's way more species in the microbiome engrafted than there probably is. Because remember, we ingest things and it passes through our system. So what we take as a fecal sample, for instance, may represent what goes through a system. It doesn't necessarily mean it represents what is engrafted. And it's the same thing when we take a swab on our skin, is that things are falling on us all the time. Like as we walk across a room, the microbes and the fungus and stuff from the room is falling on us. So we can touch something and then have microbes that are not engrafted or part of our microbiome. They're just temporarily there because they have fallen on us. Doesn't mean they're going to engraft, because they may not be able to grow. There may not be the right resources there. And that's what I think we're starting to learn, is that there are some fundamental similarities, because a lot of people for the longest time were saying your microbiome is like a fingerprint and stuff. While some of that nuance may be true, I think there's more that connects us about our microbiomes than differentiates us. While we have made slight variations because of genetics or medications that we're on, or the geography or our diets or whatever, and that is true because some of us produce more oils, therefore we'll have more lipophilic microbes on our skin. Some of us are more dry, so we'll have less. And so those types of things are absolutely true. But when you look at apples to apples, typically like on the face or on the armpits or whatever, axilla, there's a lot of similarities from person to person. And the research thus far has shown that there's more similarities from person to person than there is from place to place in the body. And so that's one of the things that's important, because if we think that way, that we have a relatively similar microbiome, at least in the components, we can get into the strain and species discussion at some point if we want, but more or less we can start to then say, well, what should that thing be doing that drives health for either the gut or the brain? And then how are they intricately connected? So let's talk about, in my analogy of the house there, one of the ways that I say things are connected is through the central nervous system, and I use the electrical outlets as that kind of thing, where there's some electrical outlets on the outside, there's some on the inside, but on the outside they're typically sealed off because of the environment. So although they have the same function, there are differences. And if you look at the gut and the skin, there are a lot of similarities. They both have epithelial linings. They both have a lot of surface area, more than we thought. So if you look at the gut just from a macroscopic level, the inside of the intestine, you don't see it. But if you look really closely through a microscope, you can see there's these microvilli, these little structures that basically increase the surface area so you can have more chance to absorb nutrients. On the skin, it's the same exact thing, where if you look on the surface, you see skin and you think, oh, I got about 2 meters squared. But if you actually calculate all of the little hair follicles that are going from the top of your skin all the way into the fat of your body, those actually make up 10 times more surface area than your actual surface of your skin. And the interesting part is that each of these places in the gut and the skin have different niches. So like in the gut, you have these little cavities where there's certain cells that secrete certain substances that do certain things and then absorb certain things. In the skin, it's the same. On the surface, you have a stratum corneum, which keeps things out, which is what the skin is mainly there to do. But then in the follicles, you don't have that stratum corneum. But you have other things that seal it, like sebum. Sebum kind of seals it off. But guess what? Inside of the follicles, you have a huge amount of microbes. And so what's in those follicles becomes very important because there's 10 times more access than on the surface, and there's no stratum corneum. So that's where that starts. Now, the whole thing is the mind. When we get to the mind, there's some budding evidence that there might be some microbes that actually reside in all tissues. For instance, it is known that certain strains of C. acnes can actually more or less hitch a ride on white blood cells. Like the white blood cells will take them in and they'll still be living and functioning, but they'll just ride around with it. And the real thing is, the question is, how does that affect the activity of that white blood cell? Does it make it more quiescent, more inflamed? And that is the reason why that's super important, is because white blood cells, once they enter circulation, can go pretty much anywhere. And so the real question is, how does all this affect, if we know that microbes actually have further infiltrated than just the surfaces? So it may be inside the house as well as outside the house. And that's a good place to start with the discussion. Dr. Patel or Angela, any thoughts on that?
Well, I'll just say that it's the conversation today, gut, brain, and skin, and I'll be really interested to hear Dr. Patel's perspective as a clinician, but it takes me back to my cancer journey. And early on, at the time of diagnosis, I was, you know, a friend had suggested that I watch a particular documentary, and it's called Heal. And it really explored, you know, different types of ways in which people have healed cancer. Mm-hmm. Quite honestly. And one of the people that was featured in this documentary was a PhD who was working in a cancer center. And there were these cases of unexplained remission, where patients were sent home and said, there's nothing else we can do. You have, you know, X number of months to live. And yet they explored alternative sources. So what they were ingesting, how they were treating their body, their mind, and so forth, and came back as healed. And this PhD wasn't questioned the status quo when she asked clinicians in that cancer center, why do you, we should be studying this. The answer that she got was, well, we don't want to give patients false hope. Mm-hmm. So they were so ingrained in their way. It kind of goes back to what we talked about previously, Dr. Mm-hmm. Patel. It's like they were so ingrained in what they were doing and checking those boxes and doing a really great job of that. Nobody's questioning that, but they weren't open to other possibilities. So she did her own study, and she looked at 1,000 cases of radical remission. And she studied them and found that there were 9 factors that they were all doing. She found 75 things that they were doing that could have related to the fact that they were now healed. She brought it down to all of them were doing 9 things and wrote a book on those 9 things. So, you know, that's probably the first time as a consumer and as a patient that it was brought to my mind that it was all connected. And I can tell you, when you get the diagnosis, you're willing to do anything. Mm-hmm. If it's an energy healing in Budapest, you're there, you know, because you're at that moment, you're at the mercy of God and the universe and whoever may be at play, and you're willing to do whatever it takes to be healed. And there's lots of information out there about what we're talking about today, that it's all connected. It's not just about what we're doing to treat the illness. It's about everything else around that illness. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts, Dr. Patel?
Well, I guess because we're on mind, right? We might as well start there, because I think the brain component of this axis is probably the one that there's the most unlearned about. Obviously, there's so much that's not been discovered, but I'm just going to take a spin on that because I apply this principle to my patients, and this is through my own journey, going through some therapy about 10 years ago. And when we look at nervous system regulation, that is so underestimated in how we live on a day-to-day basis, like you've just said about your healing journey. So I don't know if you've come across the work of Paul Gilbert. He's an amazing psychologist who wrote The Compassionate Mind about 2009. And he has a very simplistic diagram that looks at emotional regulation and brain function. So I just kind of share that with you because you can apply these principles to pretty much everyday life. And I have these conversations with patients all the time. So we have 3 systems: a soothing system, a drive system, and a threat system. And they're all governed by different hormones. And we spend a lot of our time on a day-to-day basis in drive and threat. And I'm not talking about the impact of a pandemic. I'm talking about the fast-paced lifestyle. More information does not equal better. We're constantly going. So you're constantly trying to achieve and accomplish, and that can be great, but it can also be detrimental if you're constantly going and not resting and soothing. Mm-hmm. And then if you're constantly under threat, yes, it's great to protect you from death and from running away from lions and, you know, the stuff that we're taught in med school, you know, fight and flight. But if it's chronically activated, then you end up in a traumatic state and then you can't self-regulate. So those systems all release different hormones, and those hormones then have bodily impacts. You know, sympathetic drive, we need that to be able to escape things, but we don't always want to be chronically sympathetically activated. Mm-hmm. And if we are, then that drives a pro-inflammatory cascade of events, which leads to burnout, which leads to disease, which leads to inability to recover. So I try and flip that and sit down with patients and find ways to soothe the soothing aspect. So for you, you've said that you went off and did some healing. That's activating your soothing system, which is underdeveloped. You know, when we're in a chronic state of drive and threat, we don't have time to sit down and think about how to soothe and help ourselves. So a lot of the advice, I know you'll ask at the end, how do you help yourself feel better, comes from, you know, binging on these hormones. Huberman talks a lot about stress and hormones, you know, pushing it, oxytocin and serotonin, endorphin release as your priority to heal, as opposed to looking at dopamine fixes. You know, it's the instant fix is great for a second, but if you're constantly getting that, you're going to run into addiction and crises. Mm-hmm. So you can then see how aspects that runs into depression and anxiety. And then we think, okay, what do I see as a clinician? A lot of patients who present with anxiety and depression have right on par gut issues, right on par present with the skin presentation. Mm-hmm. So once I see those patients, and I think I might have mentioned this to you before, Angela, I'm looking at stressed patients all the time. And I'm not talking about mental stress. They're presenting with a stress. Where is the stress coming from? So you unpick that. Is it the gut? Is it the mind? Is it the skin? And where do we start? So, and the joy of doing that is far more than giving someone a topical or a drug and going, yep, you're all fine now. It's the unpicking and putting the system approach together that gets you to your answer.
Yeah, that's wonderful. The both of you, those are great ways to look at this as far as, you know, when a lot of people realize that the gut does have a connection to the skin, but they just don't know to the extent. And then the brain, one of the things is what I had already said, which is it's not necessarily what you put in your body that ends up getting into your body, if that makes sense. Because if I eat sugars, the body has microbes that metabolize that sugar into other things. And in the case of our example was alcohol. But there's other things that are metabolized. And it really comes down to also the types of food we're eating. If we're eating a lot of preservative systems, that can affect the microflora in our guts. And unfortunately, and it's the same with the skin. So if we use a lot of preservative system topicals and we're laying around 10 different topicals and we're using like hypochlorous acid and all this stuff, we're really messing with the balance of the microflora. And the reason why that's a bad thing is because something is going to grow there. No matter how many preservatives or how many things, there will be something that is resistant to those systems that will grow there. And typically, the things that are most resistant are the most pathogenic. It's just one of those facts that, or one of those trends, I guess I should say, is that you tend to have things that can mutate quickly and without any type of because when bacteria are dividing, they're really replicating their DNA fast. And so there's constant mutations that are occurring. It's just that the ones that are more, the body doesn't like to have things that expend more energy. So they don't tend to get more genes or more traits. Even if you try to genetically modify them with a gene, it'll spit that gene out typically because it doesn't need it. But the fact is, when you put selective pressure, what we call selective pressure, which is if you put an antibiotic in the mix, then all of a sudden it's going to look for a way to survive. And if it's the type of microbe that is pathogenic, like for instance, C. acnes, the type that is health associated has what's called a CRISPR element. And that CRISPR element is something that's like an immune system for bacteria in a very rudimentary way. And it keeps genetic information from infiltrating the genes of that bacterium. And so therefore you have a more pure genetic code and it keeps it, what we think is why it's still symbiotic. But the ones that are associated with acne, a lot of times they have a loss of that functionality. And so they've adopted things like antibiotic genes or other genes that can actually change the way that other genes are expressed. And that can lead to dysfunction. And so when we mess around, and that's why I tell people, and I even told the kids in this my nephew's class this last week when I spoke to them, you know, I said, what I don't want you to do is go home to your mom and dad and tell them that Dr. Hitchcock said not that you don't have to take a bath anymore or take a shower anymore, because that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is you don't have to use lathery soaps everywhere on your body. And you can let your mom and dad tell you where to use them and where not to use them. But I'm telling you, on things like your arms and your legs, you don't always have to use soaps unless you have soil on your skin. And all of them were like, that's disgusting. That's gross. And I was like, well, ask your parents, you know, just because the thing is, that's psychologically, we're taught that we need to do certain things. And also with our diets, we're taught certain things as well. For instance, should we be, I know that we should drink a lot of water, but should we be flushing our systems with huge, I'm seeing people with like gallons of water that they're trying to ingest. Is that really healthy? Is more is not always better. And sometimes, like for instance, when people get these colonics and stuff, that really flushes out the microbes and it can lead to inflammation and a lot of issues. It's the same thing as those facial systems that suck out everything. They can also lead to issues because the thing is, the microbes are there for a reason. Unless you have a problem, like so if you do have dysbiosis, sucking them out and then reapplying something that's better is a good idea. But and it's the same with the gut, is if you, it's kind of like when you have a bone marrow transplant, you irradiate the bone marrow to kill it and then you put the new stuff in. It would be the same with like a fecal transplant. Well, I don't think they get, I don't know if they flush the system, but like you're trying to reintroduce something that's actually going to be better for you and hope it takes. But at the end of the day, what microbes live in your bodies and on your bodies has a lot to do with the way that your immune system reacts, because your immune system recognizes what should be there and what shouldn't be there. And unfortunately, a lot of times what happens is we just mess around with us and we have reactions and we think, oh, it's the microbes. It's not the microbes per se. It's the body's reaction to the microbes a lot of times. It can be a little bit of both. But at the end of the day, it's if we're messing around, we've caused an imbalance, and that might be that the microbes are okay. They're just the wrong numbers or the wrong proportions or the, you know, wrong location because of the way that we've been messing around with them. So, for instance, we talked about on the last podcast the sebaceous glands and how by destroying a sebaceous gland, you no longer going to make, you still have the follicle, but you won't have the sebaceous gland making the oil of the follicle. Therefore, you're changing the entire environment of the follicle. And therefore, now you have things that are going to go into the follicle that normally wouldn't go into the follicle. Because remember, sebaceous secretions also have antimicrobials in them. So it's not just that, but also the things that live, like C. acnes that populates the follicles of sebaceous skin especially, if they have much less food source there, they're less likely to be able to keep the things out that shouldn't be there. And so that's where you run into issues is when you start to forget about the balance. And when it comes, one of the things with bringing back the mind into the mix of things is that we talk about all the things that those microbes are metabolizing all the time and secreting. And when you think about that, you have to think about what effect did those things have when they're absorbed into the blood and then make their way to the brain or other areas of the body, the liver, the pancreas, you know, all the different places. It can have an effect. And one of the misconceptions people have is that more is better, and they also think that little means nothing. A lot of times, a little bit of something can have a huge impact on our health. It doesn't take much sometimes of something that's very potent. And sometimes, for instance, if you have a predisposition to a neurological issue like Parkinson's, there has been studies that have shown that you can actually cause a progression of symptoms and a progression of disease by having a certain diet, and you can actually mitigate the progression having a certain diet. And unfortunately, the diets that tend to produce the more disease tend to be more like our diets in the Western world, higher starches, more refined sugars, more refined everything, fats and stuff. And so that's where really it all comes down, it all comes back to this is that yes, we all have genetic differences. We all may be predisposed to a cancer, or we may be predisposed to Parkinson's or to acne even. But it doesn't mean that we're destined to get those or die from those or whatever, because the fact is the body has ways in which it can actually self-regulate if we allow it to. The problem is in Western culture, we tend to not allow it to because we think we know better.
I'd be curious, Dr. Patel, from a clinician standpoint, let's go back to the practice level. You have a patient who walks in the door and they've got an inflammatory skin condition, whatever that may be, acne, eczema, what have you. And if you are a clinician who's adopted this this philosophy of understanding it's all connected, gut, brain, and skin, where do you start with the clinical evaluation of a patient mm-hmm. in this case?
And I'll tell you why. I know everyone says all in diseases start in the gut. Fine. But if you are wanting to make a change, and if we're wanting to start somewhere, we have to have a level of motivation and be on the same page and figure out if we're ready to make changes. So I always start up here, actually. And I think I changed that practice because I went through something myself that required me to make that change using mental health first. Okay. So you can sit there and talk to patients and go, right, we need to unpick your diet. We need to run some bloods and stool work and panels, etc. But if there's no desire, or if there is an inherent underlying depression that's just stopping you from doing something, we have to step back and we have to think, okay, what is the simple things that we might do now that might then motivate you to make another step and take another step? So I don't always go in at gut first because it's not for me. But what I will say is the majority of the time when patients at least present with inflammatory skin conditions, I will straight in there and I'll be like, what are you eating on a day-to-day basis? And I've been doing that a lot more this year than I have in previous years. And it's amazing what you'll unpick and find. And it's not that everybody's always eating highly processed foods, but sometimes they're just not diversifying their diet to meet the needs of what we need. Or like you said before, Thomas, over-supplementing, under-supplementing, not eating enough, eating too much of the wrong thing. So unpicking that, and then I'll sit down and say, okay, let me tell you how this is affecting your skin or your brain. And that's when there's a little bit of a light bulb moment. So you've mentioned already about pro-inflammatory signals and things that happen. So if we have a dysbiotic gut, the skin itself becomes dysbiotic, and we then have this gut barrier that starts to fall apart, not completely, but starts to become leaky. And then these lipopolysaccharides, one of the endotoxins that you were, I think, alluding to, that thing flies around your body and it will lodge in your brain. It will lodge in something called your dorsal vagal complex, which is where your bowel movements are controlled. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you, a lot of this, people will have various issues, and the core is, I am bloated, I am constipated, mm-hmm. I am this and that. I'm like, okay, the endotoxin's flying around somewhere. It will lodge in your joints. It will lodge in the lower layers of your skin. And that in itself then triggers an inflammatory cytokine release. So TNF-alpha, IL-6, and inducible nitric oxide. So I start to try and say, okay, if we have a gut that's not happy, and I'm not saying because you've given too much antibiotics or not enough of this, if it's leaking, then your skin's going to show it. Your mind's going to show it. Your joints are going to show it. So maybe we have to go back and nurture and look at repairing that barrier and seeing what the impact of that is. And it's a bit amazing because some people are literally like, wow, yes. And others are like, aren't you just going to give me a drug? Aren't you just going to give me a medication? No, because I've just explained why. So the more we understand that systemic inflammation has started somewhere, the easier that this becomes to understand. And you can't separate things. I think gut is probably the central part. I mean, everyone talks about it being your second brain. I don't know. I think skin's a brain too. You know, reading the skin is giving away so much that you can sit down and analyze someone without even asking them what they eat. I think it's just the way I've learned how to deal with this. But the signals between the systems are equally as important, and what microbes release, like I'm assuming you're talking about postbiotics and, you know, those kinds of things from our gut, all influence the health and vitality of our entire system.
Yeah. So it's not just postbiotics. It's also medications that we take. So there are examples mm-hmm. of Parkinson's medications where I think it's dopamine. If you, the gut microbes, depending on what flora live there, can actually metabolize it and make it not effective. And so there are, yeah. And there's also some chemotherapeutic agents that are orally taken that actually can become less effective based on dysbiosis or symbiosis. And so there are companies, there was one back in San Diego at the incubator that I started, Zycrobat, that was starting to look at this, where they were trying to find ways in which you could actually make sure that by looking at samples of the gut or the skin or whatever, which things would not, you know, which problems you might have with certain medications, which is actually way more important than we realize. Because like I said before, if you're taking an oral medication, you might get a very different response if your gut microflora metabolizing that and turning it into something else. You have to remember, we don't get first dibs. The microbes get first dibs, and you need to make sure the microbes aren't doing something that's going to alter that. Or maybe you want it to. I mean, it's just one of those things we need to understand a little bit more about.
Well, just to throw some more into that, yes, medications influence microbes influence medications, and then you throw in the fact that some medications are notorious at reducing certain minerals and metabolites, yep. You know, calcium, the B groups. And then interestingly, not to kind of make this too confusing, but methylation cycles, I've only this year been realizing and connecting the dots that our gut flora needs to be in balance for us to have a proper methylation cycle mm-hmm. circulating. So if we're depleting in B12 and folate, which is core to those cycles, whether that's through nutrition or whether that's from an underlying autoimmune destination for you to be doing that, that throws everything out the window. You get things produced that then excite your neurons in your brain. So and then you get other things that are made in too big a quantity that really should be regulated. So everything, absolutely everything, is interconnected.
Yes, absolutely. And also, people may not realize that there's been multiple studies in animals where they've looked at the microbes that live in the skin and on in the gut, and they've done transplants and shown that they can cause obesity based on the microbes. And it's because what the microbes secrete sometimes can cause more somebody to eat more. It causes you to be hungrier more often or something like that. So we have to be cognizant that the interconnection has to do with not just the fact that the immune cells have access to these three systems, but also because the microbes themselves are secreting molecules that, based on what you put there, can actually influence the connection as well. So whether you're hungry or you're tired or you're excited, those things can actually be can be influenced by the microbes that are there eating the food that you're eating. And so it becomes very important. And how do we, so the answer is, what do we do about all this? If, you know, what can we do if the world is over-preserved, if it's over-sanitized, and that's going to lead to us being over-preserved and over-sanitized, which leads to dysbiosis? Well, there are people that are looking into this. And so some people go for more organic foods because they feel that there's less pesticides, there's less things on there to, and, you know, little dirt is probably good for our immune systems and such. There's been multiple studies where people have debated organic is not any better than another, you know, I'm not going to get into that debate today. What I would say is, any way that you can get away from something like a pesticide in your mouth is probably a good way to go if you can afford to do that. Also, overly preserved foods. It's always that there's a reason why raw diets tend to be the ones most associated with health. It doesn't mean that you have to eat only raw. It just means that it's about a rule, not the exceptions, right? You want to make sure that you can have ice cream, you have cake, but those should be exceptions, not a rule. So maybe getting out of the habit of having dessert after every meal needs to go away. Things like that, those are habits that are more socially driven than they are biologically driven. It's the same as when we, for instance, when do we go to sleep? When do we wake up? A lot of that used to be driven by light, because light actually is part of our circadian rhythm. And unfortunately, because of our artificial, the way that we do things, we tend to go to sleep when it's been dark for hours and we wake up, sometimes before it's even light out or whatever. And it can mess with our rhythms. And I know, Angela, you wear a ring or a watch or something.
A watch that measures my sleep.
And a lot of people are doing that now and understanding more sleep doesn't mean better. You know, there's a certain rhythm and you just need to stick to those cycles and then wake up. Otherwise, you're just going to be groggy. And it's the same with a lot of things other than sleep. Your diet is the same thing as well, is you have to be able to, nobody's going to care about your health more than you do. You have to do the work to think about how to thoughtfully and intentionally do everything that you do when it comes to your health. What things you put on your skin, what things you put in your mouth, what things you put in your head even.
Level at which you move your body. Stuff.
Yeah, the level you move your body, exercising. And
keeping,
absolutely. Nimble. It's all connected in more than one sense, not just because of the microbes, not just because of the immune system. There's a lot that connects these things. And I think most of us would admit that like when you have gut dysbiosis, you can see it on the skin a lot of times. But think about this. Mm-hmm. On the skin, the microbes on the skin, actually, they've shown that C. acnes of the healthy variety versus the pathogenic variety, same species, but they've shown that they can change the lineage of the T cells or the immune cells in the skin and cause them either to be inflammatory if it's the pathogenic strains, or quiescent, which is the ones that happen with the health-associated strains. And that, when you think about that, if you start an inflammatory cascade somewhere, it cascades out from there. Mm-hmm. And it's why, you know, you very rarely see only one pimple or one of anything. It's usually you have multiples because it's a cascade. Luckily, our bodies can sometimes get that under control very quickly. But a lot of people, it's out of control, and you can see the manifestation of that. So at the end of the day, it comes down to, we as human beings need to know, in our Western society, have we taken it too far when it comes to sanitation and preservation and such? And how can we take a step back and reevaluate and not unlearn, but reevaluate and evolve into where we can actually take another couple steps forward. Because I think we're probably getting very close to getting there.
I think the resources are there that will allow us to get there. I mean, Dr. Patel is a great example of that as a clinician, right? Dr. Patel, you have many resources that you've been able to access to understand what we've talked about in this podcast and the last podcast that's been allow you to evolve as a clinician. Where would you direct other Yes. clinicians who are saying, this is where I want to be. This is the direction I want to move in. I just don't know where to start. Where would you direct them? You mentioned a couple of, you mentioned one book in this podcast, I do believe.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I did. So The Compassionate Mind, if you're interested to learn about nervous system regulation, really nice. There's loads of summarized chapters online. You don't have to read the whole book. But getting your head around hormonal release and regulating nervous system is really useful, I think, for everybody, mm-hmm. regardless of whether you're a patient or not. And from that, you can then think, right, okay, soothing tools. And there's a whole range. There's an explosion of resources and practitioners and people talking about vagal toning and parasympathetic nerve stimulation. So I use a specific device that vibrates at a certain frequency to sound. I'm really responsive to that. Not everybody can sit and do yoga and meditate. You know, you have to find measures that work for you. So if it is going to be exercise, doing it at a time of day that works for you, light exposure, particularly in the morning, helps to set your circadian rhythms. So some of these things you don't even have to go outside and look for. You can do mm-hmm. these things yourself. And sleep, deep sleep, making sure that you're sleeping between the hours of 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. are your core repair hours. If we then just shift that entire cycle, you're going to miss the boat, and people misunderstand that. So they're always chronically tired. But then Huberman is great. I will keep talking about him because he talks so much about the impact of stress and regulating stress. So we all need stress, but how we manage it and how we then take a break from it. So something called micro resting, where you literally do nothing for 2 minutes. And I do this sometimes in clinic. I will just stop and I will do nothing. Because that is designed to stop you in your tracks and to get you back on track again when things are so fast paced. You can go and look at other resources, psychologists. You can look at how people, I think what's tricky here is giving you a dietary advice and nutrition advice, because there are so many types of things that people do. That is probably the most overwhelming thing. But what I'd say to somebody is, if you're not sure where your baseline level of health is, go and have some blood tests done. Go and have some health screening done, because from there you can navigate and figure out what's the right step for you. So there's so much useful information, but there's a lot of confusing information. But it's down to us. We have to make that step, take that time. Otherwise, we don't get better.
No.
This reminds me of in my cancer journey, working with an integrative oncologist who's well known out of Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I had landed on this particular doctor because I was part of a group, you know, therapy, and the coach of the group was one of his patients. And she was a breast cancer patient. She was cured of breast cancer, and 10 years later, it reappeared in her bones. And she started going to this particular doctor. And through his program, which is exactly what you just described, Dr. Patel, he does what's called a terrain panel, is his word for it. It's about $5,000 worth of blood work, where he's looking at very specific factors and knows through diet and supplements exactly how to get those factors to the range that he wants. And there was 4 women in this support group, and another one of the women had the exact same scenario. She wasn't going to be cured of cancer by Western medicine because it was in her bones. Both of these women today, following his program of just what we've talked about today, supplements, blood work, looking at certain parameters, eating the right foods to move those parameters in the right direction. Sleep is a big one. This doctor's wife is a PhD and a sleep expert. And the different factors we discussed today, both of these women today have undetectable cancer in their bones. Mm-hmm. So that's the power of what we're talking about today, the potential. You know, these are 2 cases where Western medicine was not going to cure them, but today they have what appears to be cancer-free based on bone scans. So, you know, I think that's the challenge for each of us. I love that you gave some resources, Dr. Patel. There's lots of resources out there that you can tap into, whether you're a clinician or a consumer, to learn more on this topic.
Yep, that's wonderful food for thought. I'll cap it off with just saying that, you know, of course, supplementation is one thing, but it's better if you have, you know, blood work and you have a physician that is supervising you, because again, more is not always better, and you shouldn't be just willy-nilly putting things like concentrated substances in your body. So, you know, take care to realize that the reason that that worked for that physician and those patients is because they were monitored and
he had a
target that he was looking to hit. And that's very important, because unfortunately there's a lot of marketing out there that has us like thinking more is better and just slather it on, eat as much as you want, whatever. And that can be a little dangerous, because it can actually lead to, you know, kind of a pendulum swing of dysbiosis and disease. So we'll leave it at that. So before we go, I wanted to do what I said before. I almost forgot. I did forget. They just reminded me. I want to hear from the Peanut Gallery, Seti and Alan. What did you learn from today's discussion?
Basically, one thing that I've learned through all these discussions, our gut basically has its own ecosystem. So it's an ecosystem by itself. Our mind also is one. Our skin is an independent ecosystem. But they're all also related to each other at the same time. And one can affect the other one. And, you know, they always say you are what you eat. That's one thing they've always heard. And how supplements and what you eat and how you think and your rest can affect your skin. It's not just, you know, trying to get another facial. It could be many other things that kind of affect each other. That's what I picked up from this, you know, that it's got to be a balance between everything, basically.
Well, very good.
What about you, Seti?
Yes. So what we talked today about, like, how everything is connected to each other, and like how the fact that everything is connected to each other is kind of like, the life feels like the life itself to me, because reminded me of home and my Japanese mom. I grew up in a household that they really cared about Chinese medicine more than Western medicine, to heal me with, like, if I was suffering from any headache, any like catching cold or anything. They tried to heal me with food and also Chinese herbal medicine, and they never believed in the Western medicine. So, and also my brother was raised the same way, and I remember whenever like all our classmates were like suffering from a very bad flu, we were the two ones that would never get
sick,
or even if we did, we would have just catch on like within one day, or like just a sleep, 12 hour sleep. So I feel like the conversation today kind of reminded me of home, reminded me of how I was raised, and it just, I felt connected with the subject, and I learned a lot, and I reminded a lot.
All right. So, wonderful.
Very nice.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Is my position on the podcast at risk? I'm hearing some really great discussion from our producers.
She did sit in for you before.
Oh, well. So. Don't take my job. No, that was great. Thank you, Seti.
Dr. Patel, thank you so much for joining us. Where can they find you if they want to know more information about you and your practice?
Yep. So you can find me on Instagram. I'm at Veda Skin Clinic, and I'm not on any other platforms, but I'm pretty responsive. And I tend to share a lot of the mind, body, gut, skin, life way of practicing on there.
Wonderful. And Angela, where should they find you if you would like for them to find you?
On Instagram at Angela Wilson McDonald, and at Crown Aesthetics, amcdonald@crownaesthetics.com.
Email her, everybody. She loves emails.
yeah, fill my inbox. There's not near enough in my inbox.
Yeah, and you can find me at dr.t.hitchcock. That's dr.t.hitchcock. That's on Instagram. I really don't do any other social media. And if you want to go and learn more about the company, Crown Laboratories, you can go to crownlaboratories.com or crownaesthetics.com, or look at things like biojuve.com or skinpen.com. So we hope you gleaned something from this information and this discussion. Thank you for your eyes and ears. And until next time, we'll see you later. Goodbye for now.